There was a Jesuit priest. His name was Father Walter Chizek. And Father Walter Chizek wrote a book with God in Russia, and he leadeth me. And he went to Russia to bring God to Russia. Recall, he was arrested as a Vatican spy, and he was imprisoned and sent to 35, 40 years in the gulags. And he was supposed to die, because all he received in the morning was some gruel, and that'd be for the day. And they had a break at lunchtime, but not for lunch, just a little break. But so what would happen in the prison, at some points, they would smuggle in some bread and wine. Now, he went to prison before Vatican II. And there's some older people here, before Vatican II, if you recall. The Eucharistic fast was you were not allowed a drop of water from midnight the night before if you're going to receive the Eucharist the next day. That was the fast. Right? And when they went to prison, that was the fast. So when the word went forth, the bread and wine had been brought into the camp, the people passed up the little gruel in the morning. That meant they went fasted for 48 hours without a drop of water. But they were going to do that because they were going to receive the Eucharist. And at lunchtime, when there was no lunch, Father Chizek would take the bread and water and a trunk of a tree that was chopped. He'd put the bread in the wine. And from memory, he would recite the Eucharistic prayer at the risk of his life. And then the people would come over one by one receiving the Eucharist at the risk of their lives. The risk of their lives. When he finally actually lived and he didn't die and he got out of the prison and he started to bring God to Russia. And he was involved in an Easter vigil and he started to give out the Eucharist around 9 o'clock at night. But the word went forth. People heard there's a mass, there's a priest in Russia. And they walked all through the night. They came from everywhere and anywhere, okay, to receive the Eucharist. 9 o'clock the next morning, he was still giving out the Eucharist. And he was so happy. Finally, he was bringing God to Russia. And suddenly, he was swept up and arrested and brought away. What happened was, in New Jersey, in Englewood, New Jersey, two Russian spies were captured. And they had told the Jesuits that Father Chizek had died. They buried him, as a matter of fact, up in Orrisville Cemetery, in New York, the shrine of the Jesuit martyrs. And what happened was they suddenly told the Jesuits he's still alive. And there was an agreement between the Vatican and the New York and the United States State Department and Russia to make a swap. And the swap was to bring the two Russian spies in exchange for Father Chizek. And so suddenly he was just swept up and brought back to the United States. He didn't know what was happening. He was just crushed. Finally, he was bringing God to Russia, and he was being brought to the United States. And he came back, and I know this is interesting, because I've been all through Eastern Europe. And it's interesting. You know, Eastern Europe is going to save us. In Eastern Europe. I was in, for example, the Kiev in Ukraine, and the two medical doctors, these women doctors who helped to start the helpers in Ukraine, one was saying to me, Father, she said, we went into this church, and the Holy Father John Paul II had been there about a month before me. And she's in the church, and she said, you know, 10 years ago, this is where I was baptized. I was baptized next to heaven. I said, next to heaven? She said, yes. You see, in Russia, they either closed the churches or they turned them into department stores. So in this particular church, it was a department store, and there were four floors where they sold things. And so when they came back to the church, the building, the church put on the fourth floor the baptismal. And she was baptized on the fourth floor near heaven, you see? This is what it was. Wherever I was going around the world, inevitably, incredibly, by God's divine providence, Pope John Paul II was preceding me. Okay? He was incredible. And I called him my John the Baptist. But it was amazing. All of the five continents. Amazing. I was up in Riga, Latvia. Riga, Latvia is on the Baltic Sea. It's very cold. You think it's cold? My goodness. Up there in Latvia, I said, it's rather cold. He said, are you kidding us? It's warm. I said, well, I mean, it's 0 degrees. I said, this is warm, though. We like it 30 below zero. I thought they were kidding me. They weren't. You see, it's all relative. I know he, I got off the plane, and I was like sweating, you see. I just came from snow up in New York, you see. But they were 30 degrees. But the Holy Father had been there the week before me. And he stayed at the same seminary I was staying at. And the rector said to me, he said, Father, you know, the Holy Father stayed here. I said, I heard that. He said, yeah. There was a room I was in. It was a room about the size of this area here, see. And it was just a little single bed cot in the corner. He said, the Holy Father was here. And he said, do you know where he stayed at night, where he slept? I said, no. He said, on that cot in the corner. That he insisted. That's it. Okay? And the next morning, all the pomp and, you know, ceremony. But in the evening, it was him and the Lord, you see, in the simplicity. Very interesting. But he prepared the way for me in Riga, Latvia, too. So what has happened is, in the Eastern Bloc countries, they resisted atheism. They went to the camps. They died. They suffered. They couldn't wait for their churches to be reopened. You see? Reopened. And as a matter of fact, you know now, in Hungary, they changed the constitution. Are you aware of that? They changed the constitution. As of January 1st, 2012, in Hungary now, they have made in the Constitution, life shall be protected from the first moment of conception until natural death in Hungary. Fact. You see? In the Hungarian new Constitution, it says only a marriage between a man and a woman will be accepted. No other type in Hungary. Hungary. The Polish parliament said there'd be no more abortions. The president of Russia recently signed a bill saying, well, first of all, you can't have an abortion after 12 weeks in Russia, like in Arkansas, you see? Amen. And they said that any time you advertise abortion now in Russia, you must advertise that it, part of the advertisement has to say, this is a dangerous medical procedure for the woman. Yeah, Russia, see? So you go all the way through the Eastern. They. I was going through Bratislava, Slovakia. That's one of the big cities, capitals in Slovakia. See? And it was an evening procession we were having. And I was going through this main square. And I saw all these young people kneeling on the ground. And later I said to the helpers there, I said, what was all those young people kneeling on the ground in the middle of the square at Sunday night? I said, oh, Father, there was no more room in the church. There was no more room in the church. Huh? Interesting. So what you have is they resisted and they couldn't wait for their churches to get them and throw out the stores and restore the altars and bring them back to a place of worship. All through Eastern Europe. So Father Chizek came here, and when he came here in this exchange, he looked and he said, oh, thanks be to God, your churches were never closed. You don't know how blessed you are. And then suddenly he started to go inside the churches, and they were empty. He left when if you didn't get to church on time on Sunday, you didn't get a seat. He left when there was more than one mass on Sunday. There were a multitude of masses. If you didn't get to church on time, you didn't get a seat. And now he came and he said, my God, the churches are empty. Who did this to you? The communists could learn a few things from you. How did they do this to you? Huh? And they did it to us by the word choice. Choice. You see? They did this to us by brainwashing us into... See, he said, you know, don't you realize you have become atheist? Without resistance. We went to prison. We died. We could not wait. You have become atheist in this country. You've excluded God from everything. Think about that. You see, the Ten Commandments of God are gone. And what made Western civilization great. What made Western civilization great was our laws was based on the Ten Commandments of God. That's what they were. See, our founding fathers in the Declaration of Independence, Our founding father, the Declaration of Independence, said that life comes from God, not from the state, not from your parents. It comes from God. And no one has the right to take your life. No person, no God, no state. And if they do, we declare our independence. For everybody has an absolute right to life and to pursue happiness, you see? And that was the Declaration of Independence. It's gone. It's gone. When you think about it now, each of the various Ten Commandments, I could go through them all. They're gone. And how did they do it? Choice. And what did we do? Oh, accept. No resistance. What they've done is court decision after court decision. You know, think about it. If you have a family, how do you pass on values to your children? Well, this is how we do it in this family. You see? This is tradition. See? Grandma did it this way. I know, but why are we doing it? Because grandma did it this way. And grandma, there must be some wisdom why you do it this way. See? And we're going to do it. This is the way you do it here. And as a result, you have traditions and customs, and you pass on wisdom. See, the most important thing you give to your children, the most important inheritance you give to your children, you give to them before you die. Or they're never going to get it. You give them what? Well, you give them life. Then you give them how to live life, wisdom. And you give them love. And if they have that, they're rich. You can keep your millions. If they have life, they know how to live life, and they've been loved. That's wisdom. And that's what you give, and you give it to the next generation. And so you give wisdom and guidance. See, our whole educational system, to a great extent, is it's a productive knowledge we provide for people. See, how to make a living. We teach you how to make a living. We have all very intelligent people knowing how to make an atom bomb, whatever. But we don't teach people how to live. We don't teach them how to live. And so they're dangerous. They're dangerous. They're without roots, without understanding. And one of the things is that one generation passes on to the next generation wisdom, how to live. And you do that in the law. The law is a precious gift. We don't have to start all over to try to figure out rights and duties, how to live with each other. No, that's been done by past generations, and they pass on to us the mores, the customs, wisdom, in which they teach us how to live, and they put it into the law. And in our laws, what made them so great, we incorporated the Judeo-Christian values. We incorporate the value, thou shalt not ever kill an innocent human being. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Honor your father and your mother. We used to have blue laws. Remember blue laws, you older people? The blue laws was on Saturday, all businesses closed down. They didn't open till Monday morning. It was God's business. It was the Lord's day. I remember when I was in Nigeria, the Diocese of Jos in Nigeria, and I was offering Mass with the helpers there. And Father Emmanuel Ray Ikpa said to me, Father, he said, now, for us, he said, to worship on Sunday, it's a joy, it's a pleasure. It's not an obligation, it's not a duty. He said, the Mass is not going to be short. I was the main celebrant. And the helpers made up a vestment for me, the helpers of God's precious infants of Nigeria. See? And actually, the Mass was 3 hours. It was 3 hours. And the people, many of them poor, came dressed in their Sunday best. Right? And they sang and they danced and they said, we have come to praise the Lord. And it was a joy. As you know, the church in the world has grown most in the 20th century in Africa. Do not be surprised at an African pope. Do not be surprised. People tend to think America, the church exists in America. My friends, we're only 7% of the Catholic Church, America. 93% of the Catholic Church is outside of America. I have news for you. See? And the church in Africa is booming. The church in China. The church in China is growing leaps and bounds. Okay? Leaps and bounds. And these people So it's important to keep that in perspective here. It's like, you know, the Episcopalian Church in America. Episcopalians doing this. The Episcopalian Church in America is a disaster. Okay? But of the 72 million Episcopalians, only 4 million live in America. The other 68 million think they're a disaster. A great many are in Africa. They don't agree with it at all. They know what they're doing next. Okay? God knows what they're doing next. You see? But the thing is, you tend to think the Episcopalian Church is allowing this, allowing that. No, it's not. 68 million of the 72 million disagree. Only 4 million live in America, see? But the point I'm stressing is this. It's in the law that we incorporate, we capsulize the values that we find important, and we hand it on to the next generation. Now, if you start to take the values out of the law, because some single person says, Madeline O'Hare, I don't want my daughter to hear the word of God in school. And so suddenly we say, well, you can't mention God in school. What are you talking about? She doesn't have to pray, but you can't stop all the other children from praying. Remember in the public schools, you used to start the day reading from the Bible, if you're old enough to remember that. Fact, okay? But now, suddenly, one person has removed from the law God. And suddenly, it's not just the schools. You can't pray in Congress. You can't pray anywhere. You can't pray in the public school. You can't pray anything. What are you talking about? So basically, you've taken the first three commandments and throw them out the window. Because, by the way, we adore the idol worship is our greatest problem. What do you mean, idol worship? Thou shalt have any false idols before me. Well, we do. Who is the idol? We are. Our society adores men. We don't need God. Science, technology, everything. We'll sell everything. You don't have to ask God. No more than Venus. You know, in our prayers. And the name of God, yeah, it's just, keep holy the Lord's day. No, we remove the blue laws. And now it's business, business, business. So on Sunday now, we have not the churches filled with shopping centers. We have the people in the shopping centers, but not in the church. A little bit different from Russia. They didn't have to bar the doors of the church. We're at the ball games, we're at the shopping centers, and we're not in the churches. How did this happen? You take, for example, thou shalt not kill an innocent human being. That's we used to think that, right? That's gone. That is gone. It ended with Roe v. Wade. See, in Roe v. Wade, it wasn't the end of protection of the unborn children. Roe v. Wade was the end of Western civilization. What are you talking about, Father? There was a philosophical battle that took place before that decision. We lost. And the philosophical battle that took place before that decision was rather simple. It was the right to life was absolute. No exceptions. No matter what the quality of your life was, no one could kill you. That's what we believed in. You can never take an innocent human life. Right? Now, after Roe v. Wade, in Roe v. Wade, if you read the decision itself in the very opening lines, it says this. Until the unborn child is capable of meaningful existence, it's not going to be protected. And then they divided the time of gestation into three trimesters. And it still isn't capable of meaningful existence. And it's not being protected until it's born. Now, being born, being a citizen, has absolutely nothing to do with humanity. You are a human being before, after, and until you die. There's no such thing as you're in a vegetative state, Grandma, so we can put you to death. That's nonsense. There's no such thing as you have to look human in order to be human. That's nonsense. You either are human from the first moment of your conception, or you never will be. You know, the zygote, the original cell. See, people forget this. But in every cell in your body, there's 46 chromosomes, save one. In the man, the sperm has 23. In the woman, the ovum has 23. And when the sperm and the ovum fuse, now you got 46. And the 46 chromosomes make the child different from mom and dad and anyone else in the world. And beneath the chromosomes are the genes. And you remember the great accomplishment in 2001? The Genome Project that they had, of breaking down the DNA code of life. And they were telling us this was the greatest accomplishment of mankind. It probably was. And what we did is we found out that in this original cell, that beneath the chromosomes, there were 60,000 genes that we have found. And if you were to print out the information, the chemical information contained in that original cell, it would take you 800,000 pages. And in 2002, they started the Second Genome Project. And the Second Genome Project was this. Originally, they said, if we could figure out how the genes work, we could cure diseases and illnesses. And there was, in between the genes, there was on the line there, what they called junk DNA. They didn't care what it was. It was useless. Junk, they called junk. When they started to do this second project, which now just in 2012, after 10 years, the so-called junk DNA, they found out what? You know, if you're traveling in the subway in New York City, don't be afraid, it's very, very safe. Now, if you're traveling in the subway, you have what they call switches, express, you know, and they switch the tracks. Now, if those switches are off, you've got a problem, okay? Then you can be worried, okay? But what they found out is this, that the so-called junk DNA is genetic switches that cause the change in the genes. And that's where you're going to find the solution for a gene going wrong. And the information contained in the so-called junk DNA is like 300 computer years of information. It's a whole universe. It's mind-boggling now. So that original cell, which is irreducible, that original cell contains a whole universe of information. And modern molecular biology teaches us that you are genetically human from the first moment of your conception, or you never will be. And that cell keeps multiplying. Right? So that you don't ask the question, does it look human? That's nonsense. That's outdated wisdom, knowledge. You either are genetically human from the first moment of conception, and you are so until you die. Now, when young girls go into a abortion mill to have an abortion, they tell them what? It's just a blood clot. A blood clot. Wait a second. You told me this is the greatest accomplishment of mankind, that in that original cell, right? We know that from modern molecular biology. We know that original cell contains it's a universe. It's an incredible divine designer has put in there the whole plan of your life, that they can tell from day one if it's a boy or a girl, if you have enough money. They can tell you. And they can tell you if you're going to have heart problems at 50 or not. Everything is there from day one. It's a whole set universe. And what do? Never did we know as much about life in the womb as we do today. No generation has. And never was it so disrespected as it is today. How can that be? How can that be? Let me back you up a little bit more. In 1970, leading medical journal, California. It said, it was written for the doctors, it said, look, if any doctor was to say that abortion does not kill a human being, they have to go back to school. You're nuts. Abortion kills a human being. So I'm reading the article, and I was reading it in 1970. See, I've been this a long time, see? I said, well, this is encouraging. And I continued to read. I said, wait a minute, this is discouraging, not encouraging. They said, look, there's no question that abortion kills a human life. But however, they said, we have a problem now. We have to control population. We must do it in an intelligent fashion. And we have the thing called Christian ethics about thou shalt not ever kill an innocent human being. Well, that's obsolete. And there is what we have to do is this. We have to convince people that it's not a question of we just have to kill people because to control population. And we want to do it in an intelligent fashion. And so we want to do those whose quality of life is not meaningful. Right? Not meaningful yet. And so, as determined by you? No, by others. Right? In other words, your right to life is not the absolute value and the quality of your life relative. No, suddenly your quality of your life is the absolute value that determines your right to life. And the one who determines the quality of your life, whether you have right to life or not, is others, not you. So until the child in the womb is capable of meaningful existence, on who's deciding that? The unborn child? No, sir. Who's deciding that? Grandma in the bed of pain? No, sir. Who is deciding that? The child grown in the petri dish? No, sir. It's others are deciding that, you see? And until your quality of life is acceptable to others, your right to life is relative, and you will go. Now, you say, how could that possibly be? Well, I'm out there a long time. I've been out there since 1967, right? Actively involved. And I remember in the beginning, after Roe v. Wade, that a lot of people would say to me, how do you know it's a human being on the streets? How do you know it's a human being? And I would say, well, you explain it so forth. People, when they're coming for an abortion, how do you know it's a child? Yeah. Now, I have to tell you this. No one says that anymore. No one. I hardly ever hear that. What I do hear is this: I don't want the child. I don't want the child. For what? Well, for many reasons. The quality of the life of the child is, it's sick. Or I'm sick. It's too expensive. It's going to be, in other words, what we have come to the realization now is suddenly what was unthinkable is acceptable now. It's acceptable to kill a human being. See, any article that says, use any mental gymnastics, semantics you want, never say it's killing a human being. But don't be so stupid to think it isn't. But a time will come when killing of another, because the quality of life is not acceptable, they will be open to it, then we could call it what it is. We can call it murder. We can call it killing. But it's necessary. You have to kill, because it's better off you be dead than live in this condition. Okay? And now, I say to you, now we call it killing. That's why, you see, it took 20 years to convince people that you could kill a child that is a child. Because the fifth commandment is this now: thou shalt not ever kill an innocent human being unless the quality of the life of the child or the person is not acceptable to you. Then you could kill them. Planned Parenthood put it another way. They said every child should be wanted. What does that mean, wanted? No, every child should be welcomed. Not wanted, but that's the terminology. Now, because of that, our young people are so conditioned that you can kill an innocent human being if for any various reasons. Euthanasia, I had no illusions about euthanasia. See, euthanasia was always included in Roe v. Wade decision. And I said that when the time comes, there'll be absolutely no resistance to euthanasia in the country. And there isn't. Do you ever hear any great outcries against euthanasia, which is taking place across the country? Not even a whimper. Because if you have conditioned the people now to kill an innocent, perfectly healthy child, all those reasons are now being used to kill grandma, who isn't healthy, much more so. And so what you have then is this incredible culture of death going through all the various levels from innocent child in the womb, young children. How many Down syndrome children do you see anymore? No. Professor Jerome Lejeune was a friend of mine. He was a professor at Sorbonne University. He's the father of genetics. And his whole goal in life was to find the cause of Down syndrome, because he wanted to cure them. He loved them. And I remember I had dinner with him 6 months before he died with a broken heart. Because he did find the cure, you know. He did find the cause. It's an extra chromosome 21 that causes Down syndrome. And when he discovered the cause, he rejoiced. And he went to his fellow scientists and said, I found the cause. He said, they rejoiced with me, but for a different reason. They said, Professor Jerome, you have done a great contribution to mankind. He said, I know. Now we know the cause, we can go for the cure. He said, are you out of your mind? There's too many people. Now that we know the cause, we can wipe them all out. Here in the United States, as you know, 90 out of every 100 Down syndrome children are now killed. You don't see them running around anymore, do you? In Europe, 95 out of 100. He died with a broken heart because he found the means to allow them to kill all these children that he spent his life to cure. So the mentality of meaningful existence, you don't use that word wanted. Every child should be welcomed. And so what do you do? Well, they had to, they wanted to grow life in the laboratories to stop haphazard abortions. See, haphazard abortions, they call abortions where perfectly healthy babies are being killed and babies that should be killed are not being killed. In the laboratory, we make no mistakes. We make no mistakes. So in the fertility labs, you see, what they do is every child that is conceived in the petri dish, no one is implanted in the womb unless it passes the test. Did you know that? Did you know that that test is required? Through most of Europe, if they do not pass, if they do not give the test, they go to jail. It's a pre-implantation genetic diagnostic test is given. And if the child fails the test, it's killed. Through most of the world, it is the practice since 1991. And so suddenly, and parents don't even know that. People don't even know that. In other words, in the laboratories, we are massively eugenically cleansing the human race. But to do that, what did we have to do? Well, we had to get away this stupid concept Christians have of marriage. That human life should be only conceived as a result of an act of love in the context of marriage, and will be embraced and cared for unconditionally. See, when you're born into a family, you don't have to pass the test to continue to exist. It's my child. We'll die for that child. But when you're born in a petri dish, when you're born in the laboratories, you don't continue to exist unless you pass the test, and you're not even asked, nor the parents. It's out of your control. But to do this, we have to wipe out marriage. How are you going to do that? That's like apple pie. Eh? How are you going to wipe out marriage? Well, you can't attack it directly, can you? Although now they are, practically speaking. But if we push homosexuality, if we push a man, a woman, and their relationship is equal to or the same as, there's nothing sacred and special about marriage. And besides, there's no offspring. And we can now, instead of attacking marriage, we say you're homophobic, you're against, you're some type of person, or not allow others to be equal to you. Wait, we say, wait a second. Honor your father and your mother, said God. God made us male and female. God created marriage. It's not up to us. This is not up to grabs. You can do what you want with it. Either you conform to it, or your society is broken. See, God made us social beings. And as social beings, we need one another. No questions asked. How we work together, that differs. It could be a democracy, it could be an oligarchy, a monarchy, it could be whatever it is. But we need one another. But when God made the society, the family, he made it, not us. Because he made us male and female, and he calls a man and a woman to cooperate with God to do the most marvelous thing you possibly can do on a human level. To cooperate with God to bring a human person into existence that is to be forever. And to do it with God. See? God is why it's, that's why it's vocation, vocatio, marriage. He calls the man and the woman to cooperate with God, and God, every time a child comes into existence, there's a new creation. The world will never be the same again since you were born, and you are forever. Because every time a child is conceived, there is a special act of creation on the part of God that makes the soul of that child. And man and woman work with God together to bring into existence the soul and body of a new human being who is called into existence to love God and their parents and others forever and ever. That's why sex is so marvelous and beautiful. It's one of the finest things God ever gave to us. One of the finest vocations on a human level. Called to work with God to bring into existence a human being that is to be forever, to love you and to love God and to make this world richer. And now when you separate that act from God and from life and from love, you are now on the path that you cannot defend why homosexuality is wrong. You cannot defend why laboratory reproduction is wrong. It's impossible. If you say this is God's plan and design, and we must conform to it, and it makes sense because when human life comes into existence in the context of family, it's embraced, it's loved, it's formed, it's fashioned. But if you say, your act is sterile, so what do you complain about mine? We love each other, that's all. Yeah, well you say you love him, but still, you shut out God, you shut out life, you shut out, you see. And suddenly what we did was, we took the contraceptive and took the woman off the pedestal. We took the woman as, what's different between a man and a woman? It's rather simple. A woman can give life, she bears children, I can't. What are you talking about the difference? There's a profound difference, are you crazy? He made us separate, male and female, and you work together to bring into existence. And each one has a special role. The man is the provider, the protector, the one who stands, the father of the family, like Joseph. What's the difference? Profound difference. The changes that take place in a woman's body are miraculous. It's incredible. And that's so that she can, with God and the husband, bring a human being into existence. And when you separate the act of love and sexuality from God and life, you have dethroned her. And then she becomes an object, not just a pleasure. Pornography goes. Pornography. All types of things go in. And you can't argue against homosexuality anymore. On what basis? You don't like it? Tough. If you say, no, there's a plan of God, a design, a purpose. That's why it's wrong. It's a disorder. Of course it's a disorder. Because thou shalt honor your father and your mother. Not your father and your father and your mother and your mother. That's not God's plan, design. And the child is not going to grow well in that situation. Fact. Period. Not arguable. And so what happens is, in order for life to be conceived and to be grown in the petri dish in the laboratories, you have to eliminate marriage. Because if you say, no, human life should only be conceived in the context of family, mom and dad embracing it unconditionally, in the labs there's no God, there's no family, there's no love, there's nothing. And it's all killing. Thou shalt not kill an innocent human being. We know the human being starts at the first moment of conception, the zygote. Well, we're taking all the kids frozen in the embryos, frozen in these laboratories, and killing them, experimenting on them. It's against the fifth commandment of God. It's against the sixth and ninth commandments. And suddenly, we're accepting. What in the name of God do we know where we're at? So what has happened is, the culture of death is not simply we're trying to defend the unborn child. You're trying to defend everything that's holy and sacred and right that made America great. Why people came here. Because our laws contained such wisdom and knowledge. And it was a bastion of light. You see, a place of hope. So what you're involved in the pro-life movement is actually, you're not simply, I said, it's not that the unborn children lost their lives in protection with the Roe v. Wade decision. It was the end of Western civilization. It was the beginning of accepting the unacceptable. And all the Ten Commandments of God you start to go through, they're all gone. And our kids are growing up in this culture. They're growing up in this culture, and they think it's normal. They think you're out of it. They think if you're not with it, there's something the matter with you. No, not at all. Not at all. It'll be self-destructing. And so what I mention this because the wider picture in which I want to just spend some time with is when you're out there saving the babies, actually, you're saving civilization, Western civilization. And you don't save babies. That's another thing. I want to just spend this last part now. When you are involved in pro-life movement, you say, we're here to save the babies. I have news for you. The babies are not part of the culture of death. You say, the babies are not part of the culture of death? No, they're not. They receive the effect of the culture of death, but they're not part of the culture of death. The culture of death is those doing this to the babies. And we just did the way of the cross. That's very fitting for what I'm going to say now, and to understand the spirituality of the helpers and what you're about. I say to you, the babies are not part of the culture of death, and your main reason for going to an abortion clinic is not to save babies. That's secondary. Because they're not part of the culture of death. They've never done anything wrong in their lives. There's two types of evil, moral evil and physical evil. They've never committed a sin, a moral evil in their life. And so they're absolutely open, disposed to receive the fullness of life from God, and they go directly to God. No questions asked. No questions asked. Nothing to stop it. But the people doing this to the children, their salvation is at risk. And I want you to think of yourself when you go to an abortion mill with the same mentality as Jesus and Mary and John and Mary Magdalene. Our Lord said to Peter, I'm going to Jerusalem. But Peter said, you're kidding me. They're going to kill you. He said, I know. Why are you going to go there? Well, I'm going to die out of love for the person who's going to kill me. Are you crazy? Well, Peter, you're not hearing me. The last commandment I give to you to change the world is to love your enemies. That's the sign of the Christian. And you go and you lay down your life and you ransom your life for those who are putting you to death, and you say, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. What is this? We need true Christians. We need true Christians, see? And the reality is this. Spirituality to help us is rather simple. Think of the cross. Think of the mindset of Jesus Christ. You know, the culture of death started in the Garden of Eden. It's demonic. If you don't know it's demonic, you're in trouble. Our first parents, the first sin, of course, was pride. No limitations. Choice. Free to do whatever you want. But that was, of course, don't listen to God. No limitations. You're not finite. You're infinite, without limits. God said, no. They said, God said, we do this. We go beyond our boundaries. We're going to self-destruct. No, don't listen to that. Go ahead. Choice. No, choice is limited by truth. If you go only choice and freedom, it's license. You're not free to do whatever you want to do. You're free to do what you may do. And may do is determined by truth. And if you don't follow truth, you self-destruct. If I drive into a gas station and I have a tire and I start to put air in the tire, and the guy's watching me over there for half hour putting air into the tire, he comes over to me, Father, you better stop. I said, why? Well, because in the guy who made the tire, he said, you can't put so many pounds of air, pressure. It's going to blow up. I'm getting out of here. I'm getting out of here. It's my choice. I can do what I want. Yeah, you can, but it's going to blow up. You're going to kill yourself. It's determined by the maker. The maker said, only so much pressure. Put beyond that, you're on your own. And I told you the truth before. The truth makes us free. The truth allows us not to self-destruct. And so the freedom of choice, you see, is when we determine, say, whatever we want to do without limitations. And when you do that, of course, we can begin to self-destruct. So choice without truth is license. With truth, it becomes powerful, because it's not a question of can you do it, it's may you do it. And may you do it is, how did God make you? How did God fashion and form you? He gave you an intellect that you can share in His eternal reason. It enables us to know how God made us, to reflect. You have to learn how to love. You have to reflect on the purpose of sexuality. You have to reflect on that you're a human being. And a sexual act must be spiritual and physical. The spirit, I love you and I give myself totally to you, including my life-giving powers, and we call that marriage. It has to be learned. See, so it's not a question of can you do it, it's because of may you do it. And so what happens is in our society, we have a people that don't want to have any limitations. And as a result of that, that's the original sin. God said, you can't take fruit from this tree. Oh no, the devil says, don't listen to that, do whatever you want. They did. And what happened? Their children started to kill one another. Suddenly they were estranged from God. Suddenly everything was turned upside down. Suddenly they were going to become dust. So the culture of death started when we said, we can do whatever we want. Choice. No limitations. See? And the devil said, yes. And he knew it was going to happen. But then in the Garden of Eden, God said, I'll establish a culture of life again. How? I'll send a woman and her son. And he will crush the head of the serpent. It's demonic. You cannot establish the culture of life without Jesus Christ and his mother. It's impossible. You could try everything you want. I got news for you. I've been in this for 47 years actively. We've done everything. I remember the first time I was arrested. Some of my fellow priests said, Phil, you'll never be a bishop. And I said, you're kidding. They said, oh, no. I said, when did they change the rules? When did they change the rules? I said, I thought that was a condition. I thought I was one up on you guys. And they said, no. I said, wait a second now. It seems to me, I said, that the 12 apostles, the 11 apostles, they were all arrested, weren't they? Weren't they? Didn't they die? I said, yeah, I think so. See, I said, I thought my leader, Jesus, was arrested. You see? I thought that they give you the scarlet cassock when you're a bishop, meaning you have to shed your blood for the truth. I said, when did they change the rules? They didn't. But I'm not a bishop. But anyway, what basically is with the demonic lie here is if you have an abortion, it will bring back yesterday. You can own your life again. Everything will be wonderful. Go ahead. See? I hear this all the time. See? And so we have to indicate now that if the rules is a demonic lie, and the people get misguided and misled so easily, the women come to an abortion clinic and they want to believe that. They want to believe that if I have the abortion, I can get on my life again. Okay? And you're trying to touch their hearts beforehand. But they want to believe that. You know, at Calvary, Matthew tells us that the two thieves cursed Jesus. Did you know that? Luke tells us one of the thieves, before he died, he watched Jesus saying, Father, forgive them. He saw Mary, John praying at the foot of the cross. He was converted. He said, my God, he is a king. He said, would you remember me before you enter your kingdom? Remember that? But the centurion, if you call the centurion, did not believe until after Jesus was dead. He took the lance, he put it into his side, and Matthew tells us that when he did that, the whole heavens darkened, thundered, and the curtain of the temple split in two, and the centurion said, my God, he was the Son of God. Now I tell you that because there's two types of women coming to an abortion clinic. Those who you reach, like the good thief, and you reach them before they do the abortion, and they realize, my God, it is a child. Most of them are like the centurion. They go into the abortion clinic, and they're in the recovery room, and the first reaction is, oh, thanks be to God, my womb is empty. I get on my life again. And then 15 minutes later, in that same recovery room, their head and their heart gets filled up with pain, and their self-opinion and self-esteem goes right through the floor, and they say, it was a child of God. They lied to me. And her self-esteem is down through the ground, and she feels that neither God nor man or anyone could or should love her again. And then she comes back out. And most pro-lifers are gone, because they're there to save babies. I'm not. I'm there to save souls. And God loves that woman before and after. See, that's Calvary. God loved us when we were in a sinful condition. God's unconditional love. He loved us while we sinned. He took flesh. And the woman will say to me, Father, after what I did, could God ever forgive me and love me again? And I say, Mom, wrong question. I said, God has a question for you. I can answer your question easily. Mom, God is love. He's not changeable. God never stopped loving you. Never. It's we who stop loving God. And the question God has for you, Mom, is will you love God again? That's it. Okay? That's it. And because he does. Because he wants a salvation. He wants a salvation of the abortionist. He wants a salvation of all those screaming, choice. Because he loved them. He died for them. And we are called to bring this unconditional, everlasting love of God to these people. And they need our presence more than the unborn children. If you reach the mother's heart before the abortion, the child lives. Thanks be to God. But if you don't, and the child dies, the child goes to God, but God wants the soul of this mother, and the father, and the others. And he wants you to be present to them. present to them to bring his unconditional merciful love to them. Now, if you're out there in self-righteousness and protesting and saying the blood be upon you, you're going to go to hell, you see, we're getting out of here, the baby's all dying. Wait a second. That's not what a Christian is. You know, there was a fellow called Joey. Joey was an alcoholic on drugs, a few other things. And he went into one of these programs, and by God's help, he beat them all. Became a marvelous man, marvelous man. And he then decided, I'm going to stay and help the rest of people coming through, which he did. And they all loved Joey. They all loved Joey. And one evening, this fellow who had problems himself was at a sort of religious ceremony, and he was kneeling right before the altar, and the priest was listening to him, and he was saying, he said, oh God, make me like Joey. Make me like Joey. And the priest sort of quietly bent over, and he said, you know, you should say, oh God, make me like Jesus. And the man looked up quizzically to the priest, and he said, was Jesus like Joey? Was Jesus like Joey? And I tell that story very important because outside the abortion clinic, they should say to you, pro-lifers, was Jesus like you? Was Jesus so merciful and kind and prayerful and concerned as you? He said, yes. How do you do this? Well, actually, we do this. Are you paid? No, we're not. How can you do this without... Well, because Jesus gives it the power. You see, the media loves to have two sides, confrontation. That is not to be for you. You are to be the ambassador of the unconditional, everlasting love of God to the people needed, the people caught in this culture of death. You see, Christianity is not doing something Jesus did 2,000 years ago. Christ is risen. He's not even tired. He still wants to do the work of his Father. Right? But he only could do it through you. So what you bring to the clinics tomorrow, you're bringing Jesus. Jesus continues his work today through his mystical body, the church. And they have to recognize in you Jesus. If he doesn't get home, you're wasting my time. Eh? You're wasting my time. In other words, you have to be so present. Is this the way Jesus is? You're there in love, in compassion, in prayer. Praying truly for the conversion hearts of the people. If they convert beforehand, wonderful. Baby lives, they live. But 50% of the people coming for an abortion in the United States today will repeat it. There's a 50% repeat of abortions in every major city in the United States today. Now, every time a mother has an abortion, God wants her soul. But the other thing is, if you touch her after the abortion, you bring Jesus to her. Of course, 50% of the time, without any fanfare, you're saving the next baby. You're saving the next baby. You know, it's interesting. I had, in the past few months, I had three different examples. A fellow sought me out the last prayer vigil about 2 months ago, and he wanted to thank me. And I didn't know what it was. 15 years ago, he said, you spoke to me, and my son's birthday's tomorrow. My son's birthday's tomorrow, see? And then a few weeks later, a guy was in a truck. He's in a truck, and he says, keep up the good work. I said, thank you. He said, I thank you. I said, you thank me? I said, why? He said, well, you know, I came here in the past, and you spoke to me, and my daughter's having her birthday tomorrow. And I said, isn't that wonderful? I said, how old is she? He said, it's her 21st birthday. Recently, I had a woman come to me, and she was a beautiful young woman, 24 years old. She wanted to thank me. She was with her sister, who was 21 years old, equally beautiful. But what's different about this one, they were with their mother, who wanted to thank me. And the mother said, you know, 25 years ago, Father, outside the abortion clinic in Queens, you spoke to me. And this is my daughter. And my daughter said, I want to thank you, Father, for speaking to my mother. Mm-hmm. Isn't it beautiful? You see? And because of that, I'm sure the other daughter was there. Because as they repeat, that second daughter could wipe out, no question. They lose hope. They lose their despair. See? But if you turn it around. So the idea is this. They'll never forget you. And your presence there is, and I'm stressing this, your presence there is most especially for the sake of the people caught in this culture of death. Because Jesus loves them. Jesus wants their salvation. And Where did he want to go when he came here? He wanted to go to Calvary, to Golgotha. Where is the weak spot of the pro-abort industry? It's at Calvary. It's at Golgotha. It's at these abortion mills they call medical centers. Absolutely nothing to do with medicine. You have two healthy people walking into a building. One comes out dead, the other wounded. What in the name of God has this to do with health? Why should I fund it? Why should I call it a place of medicine? It's not. It's not. It's hell. So what happens is, to be there is important to save the babies. It's important to save souls. It's important to be a light in the darkness of this whole culture. And on the other hand, I may just conclude by a few thoughts. The children, you see, sometimes we think of Jesus, artists depict Jesus as dying almost in despair. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? He's praying Psalm 22. Now, if you read Psalm 22, it's almost a description of the Passion of Christ. It's like a fifth gospel. That's why he's praying it. It's fulfillment of that psalm. Ends up in hope. Ends up in hope, see? And so what happens is he is praying the Psalm 22. So he actually was surrounded by what when he died? He was surrounded by people praying for him. Mary Magdalene, the woman, John, Mary. He was surrounded with compassion, people suffering with him. He was surrounded with love. When he looked down from the cross, he wasn't alone. And you know, Mary was, she was a Jewish mother. Huh? There's no way she didn't speak to her son. No way, okay? And I know what she said to him. She said, Jesus, look, you were conceived in my womb, and you took your humanity and you united to your divinity in your person, and you became a priest. That's the moment of conception. Jesus became a priest. And I know that, Jesus, this is the sacrifice. You're offering your life. You see? And in this moment, you're never more pleasing to your Father. This is the sacrifice redeeming the world. And she said, Jesus, I know what she said to her. She said, Jesus, you stay right on that cross. And I will stand here in prayer, praying with you until you complete the Father's will. You know, I know Jesus spoke to Mary. We all know that. He said, Mary, you know, you are sinless. Sinless. Right? You're sinless. You have no reason to be here. Reparation for sins? You are sinless. You're the Immaculata. You see, the Immaculate Conception. You're the new Eve. But you know why we have you suffering? Because in the plan of God, in the plan of God, we intend you, Mary, not only to be my mother, but the mother of all those who would be born again in Christ of me. You are the spiritual mother of the church. John, I give you a final gift. It's not the Eucharist. It's my mother, your spiritual mother. John, behold your mother. Mary, behold your son. The last gift that God gave to you was Mary. Do you understand that? Don't spend your whole life neglecting your mother, because she never neglects you. The Eucharist and that final gift is marvelous, isn't it? And the final thing I say to you is this. Look, people sometimes say to me, Father, suppose there's no turnarounds. Was it worth going? No turnarounds. Was it worth going? Worth being there? And I have to say to you, at the first Golgotha, the first Calvary, no turnarounds. Jesus died. But he died surrounded by love, compassion. The unborn children should not die without someone recognizing their existence, someone praying for them, suffering with them, and loving them. And when you and I die, and truly we will, when we stand before God, we're going to find out these unborn children will say to God, Jesus, I had a very short life on earth, you know that. But they recognized my existence. They prayed for me. They suffered. They loved me. These are my friends. Let them in. And he will. Why are so few people standing outside the abortion mills? Because there was only 5 people standing at Calvary. Why? Because the mob was yelling, Barabbas, Barabbas. Choice, choice. And only 5 people were able to stand and say, no, Jesus, Jesus. This, the innocent, precious Son of God. Barabbas. 11 of the 12 priests weren't there, you know. We tried to keep the record going, by the way. was only, most of them were women, it's always the case. It seems like, what's the difference between a man and a woman? Sometimes I think it's courage. There were four women at the foot of the cross. Four women, okay? Because their emotions, they were attached to Jesus. It wasn't just an intellectual thing. They were connected, you see? They were connected. And so the women are there, and because they were there, we know the final words of Jesus. We know what he said, Father, forgive them. He knows, we know the final gift of Mary. You see, we know everything, see? And if they weren't there, we wouldn't know that. And here it is 2,000 years later, and everybody knows the five that were at the foot of the cross. And those who weren't there would give their left and right arm to say they were there. They were there. A time will come and there'll be a resurrection, a new life, a new culture of life. This culture of death will die because it's not of God. God will win, no questions. And people will ask, did you know where the killing was? Did anybody know where the innocent ones were dying, where the mothers were being exploited? And we say, yes, we did. Was anybody there? Was anyone there? Was your grandparents there? Was your father there? And it'd be good for the children to be able to say, yes, my dad, my mother was there. They stood at the foot of the cross. And they gave the witness, not Barabbas, Jesus. This is God's precious infants. And we have come to help them and their mothers. And that's what we're all about. So tomorrow, if you can, after Mass, we shall bring Christ and his Blessed Mother and mercy to the people going there. We shall pray for the holy innocents. And we shall be able to say, yes, Jesus, we knew what was happening. And with your grace and your help, we were there. And from that changes the whole world. Changes the whole world. So I invite you to be with us. The Mass is tomorrow, I think, is at 8 o'clock, is it? 8 o'clock. Here, in this church. And then within an hour, actually it's about an hour and a half, we'll be finished. We'll be back at the church for closing benediction. And then after a brief break for lunch, I teach people what we do after the large prayer vigils. The large prayer vigils have been effective all over the world. All over the world. The amount of people's hearts have been changed. Mothers have been converted. We just had the largest abortion clinic in the United States close. But it wasn't closed. It was a total conversion. The people who ran it are now pro-life. And the building is totally being used only for life-giving things. See, so that's a great thing.